Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. From the Karolinska Institute in Sweden comes a study about how exercise stalls cancer growth through the immune system. People with cancer who exercise generally have a better prognosis than inactive patients. Now, researchers at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden have found a likely explanation of why exercise helps slow down cancer growth. In this experiment, physical activity changes the metabolism of the immune system's cytotoxic T cells and thereby improves their ability to attack cancer cells. This was published in the journal eLife. Well, wouldn't it also apply then to prevent cancer if you're exercising? So the biology now we better understand. And yet historically we've told people who are sick, rest, take it easy. As you get older, take it easy. And as a result, we have a lot of people over the generations who have become very sedentary in their lifestyle, not realizing this contributes to dementia, cancer, oxidative stress, demineralization of the bone, all these terrible things. Just get out and exercise. The older you get, the more you should be focused upon a daily exercise program. And in this case, it worked. So they divided some mice with cancer into two groups and let one group exercise regularly in a spinning wheel while the other remained inactive. The results showed that cancer growth slowed and death decreased in those that exercised. We have more to come. In a moment, we're going to talk about a university in Berlin that showed that chia seeds as a potential cognitive booster in the APP23 Alzheimer's disease model. Something that simple. Chia seeds helping with Alzheimer's? Yes, it's called functional quality, meaning there's a function within the body that every nutrient, every food has. We just have to discover. And when we do, we think, wow, you mean that could help lower blood pressure, could help with dementia, could help with, yes, all the more reason to be paying attention. Today also, we're going to have a guest live, and that is Dr. Paul Marik, M-A-R-I-K. He'll be on Zoom from Norfolk, Virginia. He is a distinguished professor of internal medicine. He is also chief of pulmonary and critical care medicine at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk. And he's not only a medical doctor, but holds fellowships in the Canadian Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons, the American College of Physicians, and the American Board of Physician Nutritionist Specialists. He has authored over 400 peer-reviewed journals, 50 book chapters, and 4 books on critical care for physicians. And he has also developed a very successful treatment for the life-threatening infections associated with sepsis, which is responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths every year in the United States alone. The treatment is based upon vitamin C combined with select steroids. More recently, his COVID-19 treatment protocol also requires nutraceuticals, vitamin D, B-complex, magnesium, and quercetin. So why is this gentleman, who is at the heart of orthodox medicine, academia, is a professor, but also is a clinician in the front lines every day in critical care, emergency care, why is he now being attacked as if he were a snake oil salesman, a pseudoscientist, someone that you would see regularly pillared on Wikipedia? Well, could it be because his vitamin C is helping people? Oh, and by the way, many of those symptoms that end up hurting people with lung conditions could also maybe be used for other upper respiratory tract infections like, let's say, COVID-19. We'll have him on to explain. Also today, I didn't have a chance yesterday, but Robert F. Kennedy is being attacked also. So we're going to play you his response. And then from Barbara Fisher, one of the brightest, most courageous advocates out there for freedom of choice when it comes to vaccines, she has an important message. It's about 6 minutes long. And then to round it off, what it's like being a millennial. Well, you'll see. So that's our program. We have a lot to share. I'm going to try to squeeze it all in. So now there is this study, And people don't think of chia seeds very much. It kind of, you put it in and it gels. And it's very good as a fiber. It's very good for digestion. It's very good for people who have, let's say, an overly acidic system and may have diverticulitis or spastic colon or Crohn's disease. It's very gentle on the digestive system. Well, what we have seen in this study is that chia seeds can help boost cognitive ability in persons with Alzheimer's. And that's what this conclusion was in the actual peer-reviewed study. So take your chia seeds if you have Alzheimer's. But another thing you should take, according to the University of Southern California, another article, high-dose omega-3 fatty acids can slow Alzheimer's progression. They're known to be good for your heart and good for your circulatory system, but did you know that high doses can also slow cognitive decline? It's been studied extensively. There are thousands upon thousands of studies on the omega-3 fatty acids as a therapeutic intervention, demonstrating promise in the treatment of neurological conditions like bipolar, even severe depression. So in a quest for safe, effective treatment options for cognitive decline, researchers at the University of Southern California tested omega-3 supplementation for potential value in slowing the onset of Alzheimer's. And this was a first-of-its-kind clinical trial. According to the senior author, Dr. Yasmin, who's a professor of medicine neurology at the Keck School of Medicine at USC, there is significant research supporting the preventative potential of omega-3 fatty acids. So they did this trial, and it slowed Alzheimer's. That's something medicines cannot do. It turns off inflammation. And so that's what they were finding. And so we just should be taking more of the omega-3 fatty acids. But look, if you have avocados, walnuts, any of the omega-3 seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds, the oil, that's all also rich in omega-3 fatty acids. Now, to do one more on Alzheimer's, since we have so many positive approaches to Alzheimer's today, from Hazong University of Science and Technology in China comes a study about beta-glucans, beta, B-E-T-A, glucans, G-L-U-C-A-N-S. That's a supplement, and it prevents early-stage pathologies associated with Alzheimer's. That's the latest report on this study. It is strongly protective of otherwise neurodegeneration diseases that remarkably impose a huge global health burden because more people get old, more people suffer from Alzheimer's, which is a form of dementia. So the yeast beta glucans have been incorporated in functional foods and used prophylactically on the biology of people to help slow down Alzheimer's. Again, it's just one approach, one piece of a very large puzzle, but it works. Now, mind you, we just mentioned three different things that help with dementia and Alzheimer's. So there's many more. I'm just giving you the ones that are brand new. From the University of Cantabria in Spain comes an article published in the Endocrine Society's Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. What they're saying is this, that over 80% of COVID-19 patients have vitamin D deficiency. That's a big deal. That's something we can correct. Now, we know that vitamin D is a hormone the kidneys produce that controls blood calcium concentration and impacts the immune system. And vitamin D deficiency has been linked to a variety of health concerns, although research is still underway into why the hormone impacts other systems in the body. But many studies point to the beneficial effect of vitamin D. There's probably 30,000 studies or more on vitamin D. Many of those are on the immune system, especially regarding protection against infections. Now, we're all going to be exposed to viruses and bacteria. We all have billions of bacteria, trillions of bacteria in our body, lots of viruses. That doesn't mean we all get sick. Vitamin D is just one very important piece of the puzzle, especially if you're high risk, meaning you're older and you have comorbidities, or you're in a nursing home, assisted living center, and certainly hospice care. But what about if you're at home, you maybe don't have the money to go into a nursing home or assisted living care? That can be very expensive. So you just have to tend to yourself. Well, if you're overweight, that's a comorbidity. If you have lung conditions because of smoking possibly or working in a polluted environment, that's a comorbidity. Cancer is a comorbidity. Heart disease is comorbidity. High blood pressure. These are all comorbidities. So you then begin to see that we have an awful lot of people with multiple comorbidities. And the more comorbidities you have, the more susceptible you are. Therefore, all the more reason to take your vitamin D every day. And I believe we're taking far too little vitamin D. I will give you a senior citizen protocol within the next couple weeks for everyone in the audience. So this way, no matter what is going on in your body, you can be helped. Because I do not see how we're dealing with the so-called herd immunity, and I am not a supporter of the herd immunity. I wrote an article on it, challenging it. Now, most scientists, most clinicians, most people believe in herd immunity. Well, that's fine, except what about all the times that people who are fully vaccinated, and therefore should have been protected, came down with the very condition that they were supposedly protected, but they weren't. And there's no universal statistic of how many people have to have an infection before you have herd immunity, or a vaccine for that matter. Is it 96%, 98%? Because there are countries like China that mandate vaccines, therefore they have absolute herd immunity, but theoretically, but then people come down with measles and chickenpox, etc. In the United States, I've heard figures as low as 20%. Well, there's a big gap between 20% and 98%, but I believe that we better understand first and foremost the immune system. So here's a question for you. How many people in this audience have heard public health officials, Fauci, the Surgeon General, for example, the head of the National Cancer Institute, head of the national, the FDA or the CDC, coming forward, even with their experts, and say, here's what you can do to create a better immune system, and as a result, keep yourself more at an advantage of staying non-sick or minimizing your sickness? Now, that we've shown that with vitamin C and the common cold. Multiple studies show that the more vitamin C you take, the less likely you are to have a cold or the quicker you recover. The same is also true for the flu. But what I do not see a vaccine-induced herd immunity. If you see it, show it to me. And I'll show you how bad their science is. For example, let's say that 1 million people get the flu vaccine. And then at the end of the year, they're all checked and they say 10% came down with flu. Then immediately the CDC and the entire medical industry will say, it had a 90% efficacy. That's completely fraudulent. That's junk science. What about the people living in highly stressed areas? What about the people who are living in non-stressed areas? What about the people who got sunshine every day, which is the moon booster? What about the people in Florida, Texas, California, drinking orange juice every day because it grows there? What about the people outside all year and could exercise? That boosts the immune system. What about those who are vegans or on a healthy plant-based diet? What if they didn't get the flu? Now you're giving 100% of the credit for their lifestyle to a vaccine. That's fraudulent science. And that's what almost all vaccine science is today, is fraudulent. They don't talk about cellular immunocausal immunity. They don't talk about humoral serological immunity. And so if you want true unbiased science, you have to have double-blind placebo control. That means a saline solution, and then follow people for a period of years. And they've never done that, not once. So they want to have you believe you don't have to do anything. You can continue drinking, smoking, eating garbage, being overweight, and having high inflammatory cytokines flushed throughout your body because of the french fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, grilled cheese sandwiches, milkshakes, sugar that you're consuming. Don't worry about any of that. Instead, this is this intramuscular injection of a lab-produced viral antigen with toxic preservatives like aluminum, formaldehyde, polysorbate 80, and these adjuvants, They're all that you need to give you an immune boost. Really? Well, that's interesting. Because I know, and it's a matter of scientific fact, that humoral serological immune system that produces antibodies is only one part of a very complex two-part immune system. We never have anything discussed about that. They're talking in theory. Let's look at the facts. The facts are that, and by the way, this is, there's something very simple. You have to stimulate your own innate cellular mucosal immune system. Now, what is the cellular mucosal immune system? And by the way, show me a single scientific study that the injected vaccines do absolutely anything except to weaken the immune system. And that's because of the cellular toxins that are in all these vaccines, like aluminum, mercury, polysorbate 80. The mucosal immunity is located in the mucous membrane of the gastrointestinal respiratory tracts and their lymph nodes. The humoral, H-U-M-O-R-A-L, immunity, with production of antigen-specific antibodies by plasma cells in the bone marrow. And for a long time, and read Dr. Harold Buttram, B-U-T-T-R-A-M, he has written on this extensively, because the mucous membranes, the gastrointestinal and respiratory tracts, are, and this is not in debate, the primary sites of infectious microbes' entry into the body, so that, of necessity, cellular mucosal immunity has evolved as the primary defense system, with humoral immunity serving as a secondary or backup role. Vaccines are reversing their roles, attempting to substitute vaccine-induced humoral immunity for the far more efficient cellular mucosal immunity, the latter in turn undergoing a process of atrophy of disease as a result of this vaccine-induced role switching. So people should know this. They should know, what do you do to stimulate your immune systems at all levels? And they're not. And the journalists are not helping with any of this either. Just want to share that with you. We're 18 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to share some insights on this particular topic. And I think it's important that we go a little further, all right, in understanding what role can we play each day in not overreacting to the information coming from the pharmaceutical industry. Hence an article we posted today called "The Big Lie: Autism is Only About Genes." I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We have a lot to share. I'm going to try to pack as much in as I can that's meaningful. Before I go to my article, I want to respond to what is happening worldwide. All of the leading advocates for freedom of choice who are trying to look at the COVID pandemic and see what is legitimate, what is not, how are we being adversely affected, they're all being attacked. Journalists are attacked, lawyers are attacked, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., scientists, medical doctors, and of course the lay public. Right out there in front is RFK Jr. Here's what he had to say about being attacked by sharing accurate, scientifically proven information about COVID and other 5G and other things that they're now labeling him as like a conspiracy theorist. Anything but. Here's RFK's response.
Hey buddy, it's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. here, and I cannot tell you how happy I am to be able to have this opportunity to talk to thousands of citizens in 15 countries on all the continents in the world who have come together today to protest this coup d'etat by big data, by big telecom, by big tech, by the big oil and chemical companies, and by this global public health cartel led by Bill Gates and the WHO that now amounts to $2 trillion and wants to magnify and amplify its wealth and its power over our lives, over our liberties, that wants to subvert our democracies, that want to destroy our sovereignty and our control over our lives and our children's health. And I want to remind you, those of you who are not Americans, of something that every American child learns when we're growing up in this country about our history. During the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt, who was one of the greatest presidents in American history, said to the American people, "The only thing that we have to fear is fear itself." And we grow up hearing that, but people don't really understand what it means. But it was a very, very profound warning by Roosevelt, because he saw what the Great Depression was doing in Eastern Europe, in Italy, in Germany, in Spain, where that crisis was turning people towards fascism. In the Eastern countries, where the same crisis was turning citizens and governments towards communism, and also causing the collapse of governments all over the world. And in our country, in the United States, it's hard for people to remember today that almost a third of the people in our country were completely disillusioned with capitalism and wanted to turn to communism, and another third wanted to turn to fascism. And Franklin Roosevelt wanted to preserve our country for democracy, for free market capitalism, for civil rights, and to preserve our Constitution. And he recognized that the weapon of authoritarian control was going to be fear. And when I spoke a few weeks ago in Berlin, I reminded the people of Germany of a very famous story that happened during the Nuremberg trials after World War II, when Hitler's closest lieutenant, the head of the Luftwaffe, Hermann Göring, was asked by one of the prosecutors, "How did you get the German people are the most educated people in the world, they were some of the most tolerant people in the world. The Weimar Republic was one of the strongest democracies in the world. How did you take these people who were so well educated and so awakened and so tolerant and turn them into obedient slaves who committed some of the worst atrocities in human history?" And Göring said, "Oh, that's a simple thing." And any of you can look up his quote, and I urge you to do so. And he said, "And it works not just in a fascist government, but it works in a democracy, in a monarchy, in a communist government, in any government that you want. The job of the government is to put the people in fear. And if you can keep them in fear, you can get them to do anything that you want them to do, that they will turn into sheep." And there's a famous book by Naomi Klein that all of us should read called Disaster Capitalism. And that book shows, it's a historical chronology of all of the times during American history and the history of the world during the Great Depression, and during the financial collapse in 2008, and during the financial collapse in Chile, for example, in 1973, during the time of the World Trade Center bombing, that authoritarian elements in a society and large corporations and wealthy plutocrats and oligarchs, wealthy families and individuals, use crises to shift wealth upward, to obliterate the middle classes of those countries, and to clamp down totalitarian controls. And of course, it's an obvious thing that people who are used to voting for their governments not going to vote for policies that make the rich people richer, that give corporations even more power over their lives, that reduce democracy and reduce civil rights. These are not good vessels for populism. In order to transform the government so that it will reward the rich with even more wealth, the people who want to do that, the large corporations who want to orchestrate that kind of change, have to get rid of civil rights. And the first civil right that they begin with is freedom of speech. They need to clamp down censorship, because censorship is the most important right. In our country, we put it number one, the First Amendment, the Constitution, because all the other rights depend on it. If a government can hide what it's doing, it can get away with anything it wants. If a corporation can lie to you and conceal information, if there's no transparency in a democracy, you do not have a democracy. Oh, if you want to get rid of all the other rights, like freedom of assembly, which you are exercising today, some of you are exercising at great threats. Some of you will suffer. Some of you will be jailed. Some of you will suffer injuries. But that is a basic right. The right to freedom of expression, the right to jury trial, the right to freedom of religion, the right to privacy, the right to have governments that don't spy on you and keep your information. All of those other rights can only be subverted if they begin by imposing censorship, by being able to silence people who want to speak. So the coup d'etat that we are all fighting today is a coup d'etat that starts with a conspiracy between the government agencies and the big technology companies, the Silicon Valley billionaires, people like Zuckerberg and Bill Gates, and the people who run Google and Facebook and Pinterest and all of these other Silicon Valley corporations who are now in this conspiracy, and make sure that we cannot talk about our grievances. We cannot say bad things about pharmaceutical products. We cannot question government policies that make no sense to us. And I'm going to say a few things about some of those government policies. Number one, I am not a conspiracy theorist. I follow the facts. I don't know that the COVID illness was laboratory generated in Wuhan. There is plenty of evidence that it was, but not enough evidence for me to say that it's a fact. My question is, why don't we know the answer to that? Why is Tony Fauci not being asked that question? Why is President Trump not launching an investigation? Or President Xi, or the presidents of any of these countries, saying, where did this come from? Because we need to know that. The global citizens, this is the worst calamity in history. And nobody seems curious about where this actually comes from. We know it didn't come from a bat in the wet market in Wuhan. And that story was a fable that it now has no basis, in fact. And we have Nobel laureates, and we have large institutions and investigative agencies and prosecutorial agencies are saying, we think it came from the Wuhan lab, and we think that it may have come from studies that were funded by Bill Gates and Tony Fauci. I don't know if this is true. But why are our government officials not asking that as the number one question? Why, instead of sending their police to suppress dissent, are they not sending the police to question people who may know the answer to that question? There are many other questions that I'd like to know the answer. Questions about masks. I'm very willing to accept.
There are all kinds of people paying a lot of money to pull strings behind the scenes to make sure we see certain things on TV and on the news and read things on the news, and that we do not see certain things on the news.
Much of the media today seeks to advance narratives to the exclusion of facts, fairness, and accuracy, says Cheryl Atkinson, a five-time Emmy Award-winning investigative journalist. In many cases, there are big interests and big money involved. At the same time, big tech curates what people are allowed to see and applies third-party, quote, fact-checkers to dictate what is accepted truth.
I wanted to play that little piece because we'll be having a segment with Cheryl Atkinson, five-time Emmy Award reporter, really outstanding investigative journalist, on later this week. But I wanted that as an introduction to my guest, who's been standing by. I'm going to hold off on my own article, The Flawed Blind Spots in Calculating COVID-19 Deaths, that we will report on later today or tomorrow. But instead, I gave you Dr. Paul Merrick's biography earlier as a distinguished professor of internal medicine, chief of pulmonology and critical care medicine at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk. And nice to have you with us today, Dr. Merrick.
Sure. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, sir.
Okay, that's good.
Dr. Merrick, before we get into your particular issue concerning vitamin C, which should have been a relatively simple and straightforward discussion with the scientific community, I want to just relay something that happened back in the mid-1970s. Because at that time, in the early 70s, I was on WMCA radio before I came over where I've been for 44 years on WBAI and later the Progressive Radio Network. You're being heard on both now throughout the world. Linus Pauling called me. I knew Linus Pauling. He used to come by the Institute of Applied Biology when he was in New York, where I was a senior research fellow and head of the anti-aging division. And we would talk for hours on end about science, aging, etc. And his only regret was that he hadn't got into vitamin C earlier than when he had, or he would have believed he would have lived a longer life. In any case, he had finished a study on vitamin C with Dr. Ewan Cameron at the Vale of Leven Hospital in Scotland. He worked only with terminally ill patients, and those patients were given 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C per day. And they had a length of life and better quality of life in some of those patients. But the Mayo Clinic supposedly duplicated his study and said that there was no difference. And that's the only thing the American Medical Association Journal and other publications put forth. No difference in vitamin C, hence it doesn't work. So Pauling came on to say what was wrong. They had not followed his protocol. It was not the same protocol, not the same type of vitamin C, not given the same way, etc. And he said that they intentionally, in his belief, they intentionally created a study to fail. And so for the rest of his life, Pauling was not able to convince the world that vitamin C played a role in cancer. Today, we have a lot of peer-reviewed studies that show that it does. Now, when I watched your conference, and we played part of that conference yesterday, we didn't get to the part where you talked about it is entirely possible, and Dr. Angel, the 22-year editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, wrote a whole book on that, did articles on it, of how bad much of peer review science is. 67% of the studies cannot be duplicated by the original author or by others, which makes them junk science. But also we've come upon this phenomena of many of the proprietary interests creating studies that either slant it with a bias to show positive outcomes or create a study that is intended to fail. I believe that that was one of the comments you were making, but in this respect, it kind of reminded me that you are, in effect, saying something that Linus Pauling said, different reason, but same outcome, sepsis. Hundreds of thousands of people die in the United States, and you had a relatively inexpensive, simple, completely safe a protocol that could help many of these people, help them live, help them reverse their sepsis. That should have been non-confrontational, non-pejorative attacks against you, and yet just the opposite happened. Take it from there, sir, and tell us what you found, the response by the mainstream scientists around the world, people who should have been on the phone or on a computer communicating with you instead of attacking you before they had any conversation with you. The forum is yours.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, this started in January of 2016. I was in the ICU. We had a patient with overwhelming sepsis. She was clearly going to die from sepsis, so, you know, as a thoughtful physician, you think, you know, you have to think out of the box. What can I do to help this lady? So I had read about Dr. Fowler's work and some of the workers in Belgium and on vitamin C. And I thought, you know what, let me give it a try. So we gave this patient vitamin C and not really thinking that anything would happen. So this was intravenous vitamin C. And the next morning, she was like 1,000 times better. She was weaned off the ventilator, and she made a full recovery. And this was a patient who I think had an almost 100% chance of dying. So we were kind of amazed, but you know, it was a once-off thing, so we thought we'd try it again. And the same thing happened, and we did it again, and the same thing happened. So we thought, wow, this is pretty amazing. So we made it the standard of care in our ICU. You know, it was saving patients' lives. And that's what our goal as physicians were. We were obviously concerned about side effects, so we monitored these patients closely. We reviewed the literature and knew that it was exceedingly safe. So, you know, we collected a cohort of 47 patients who did extremely well. And we compared this to a similar group who had been previously treated and showed a big difference in mortality. So I presented this first. So, you know, we put a paper together and I presented this first in Ireland in 2017. And basically I was laughed at. You know, people just thought it was impossible. It was not feasible. And the study was flawed and all kinds of attacks, and that we needed a randomized study. And unless you did a randomized study, our data was meaningless. And, you know, I was ridiculed and mocked from around the world. I mean, people called it snake oil medicine and all kinds of things. But we knew it worked, and there is an exceedingly strong basic science data to, you know, to support this. So this was not something invented. I mean, there must be at least 300 or 400 basic science studies which have evaluated vitamin C, and there's a sound physiologic basis. So we've continued to use it. The problem has been that there have been a few randomized controlled trials. One, which was quite well done, was a little bit underpowered. It showed a benefit in terms of organ failure and pressor time, but not mortality. And then we come to the problematic studies, which I believe were designed to fail. So the first was the vitamin study out of Australia. So they in no shape or form try to reproduce what we did. So, you know, what we did, like in the first patient, is when the patient came to the ICU, we treated them immediately, just like you would with an antibiotic. No disease benefits from a delay in therapy. And sepsis, like heart attacks and strokes, is a very time-sensitive disease. So we treated them early. In the vitamin study, we actually don't know the time delay because they've never been able to figure it out. But we know it's at least 18 hours, maybe even more. We don't know from the time of admission to the time they got their first dose. Secondly, all our patients came through the emergency department. So these were patients with acute sepsis. In the vitamin study, there was a whole mixture of patients. Some came from the operating room, some came from the medical floor, some came from the ED, some were surgical patients with abdominal sepsis. So it was a completely different group of patients. So they were, you know, the patient makeup was different and there was a big delay. So that was the main problem with that study. Then the ACT study was recently published, which is even more problematic because 26% of the patients enrolled in the study had malignancy. And the commonest cause of death in that study was withdrawal of care for a terminal illness, not sepsis. So they, you know, our vitamin C protocol is not going to cure patients dying of a malignancy who's septic. Furthermore, there was a time delay. Furthermore, we're not sure that all patients received 4 doses. I mean, dosing for 4 days. You have to give at least 12 doses. There was a study out of Korea, which makes no sense. They gave patients four doses for 2 days and found no difference. So if you design a study which is going to fail, it will fail. And so, you know, these people in the ivory tower, you know, they say that it's a hoax. There's no data that it works. And in fact, one of the leading ID doctors said it's unethical to give it. So the problem really has been, apart from the one study by Dr. Iglesias, the Oranges study, in which they enrolled patients from the emergency department and kind of followed our protocol. It was well done, except, you know, it was a small study. All the others have not tried to reproduce what we have done. Nevertheless, if you put all the studies together, it does show some biological effect in terms of less organ failure and patients get off vasopressors quicker. So we know it has a biological effect. So that's where we are. You know, I think people don't like cheap, effective drugs. It goes against their DNA. It's very safe. We know that. Yet, you know, it's, you know, because of these negative studies, it just hasn't got any traction.
Okay, let's look at something that is very unusual. You've authored more than 400 peer-reviewed studies. You've written over 50 chapters for books. You've written 4 books that are seminal for critical care for physicians and hospital nurses' usage. And yet, in all that time, in all these 30 years of clinical practice, including being a distinguished professor of internal medicine, a chief of pulmonology and critical care, generally those types of credentials mean that you have relatively civil conversations with people on any given issue. You can disagree, of course. That's part of what an open society does. They disagree. But they didn't disagree with you. They went on an attack to destroy you. Right now, we were looking this morning before this program, you are being attacked left and right. And many of the people attacking are medical doctors or scientists. And I'm imagining, and you'll tell me if I'm right or not, that they have not decided first before attacking you to see whether or not what you have done with your research from that one woman to 150 when you made your first appearance in about 1917 to now 1,500 patients you've worked with and said, okay, I've worked with 1,500 patients. Here's my protocol. Here's my evidence. Here's the articles I published in peer-reviewed journals. Here's the clinical experience. Here's my staff, if you wish to interview them. How many 1,500 patients with sepsis in the general hospital system would still be alive at the end of the same period of time, over 3 years? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you could have a dialogue. But they haven't done that, have they?
No, you know, so, I mean, you know, we got some people to interview our nurses because they have no vested interest. But they were extremely supportive because they, at the bedside, you know, they look after these patients. And it was their experience, and, it, you know, it's not fictitious that patients who they thought would die survived. They were titrating the vasoactive drugs, and patients got off much quicker. So they were actually, I mean, they believe in it. And when we considered doing a randomized controlled trial, they thought it was unethical to randomize patients to placebo. I mean, how can you give a patient placebo when you have an effective therapy to treat a disease? So, you know, they were our strongest advocates, and clearly they had no vested interest at all, except in having the best outcome for their patients and telling the truth. But as you know, the truth is not always what you think it is. People like to distort the truth for whatever reasons. And I think there are powerful economic factors at play, you know, because as we see with COVID, the pharmaceutical companies do not like cheap drugs that have no, that or off patent that can save lives.
Such as hydroxychloroquine with zinc and zithromycin?
Yes. So actually we have a new one. which is truly astonishing, is ivermectin, which is even cheaper than any of those drugs. Over 3 billion doses have been prescribed across the world for parasitic infections. And what we know is it's highly effective against SARS-CoV-2, and is a profound anti-inflammatory drug. And the idea that you could use, I mean, in some countries it's so cheap, they just give it away. Nobody seems to be interested in studying it because nobody's going to profit. It's truly shocking. And, you know, I mean, nobody can ignore what's happening around us in this country. We're heading towards a total disaster. We had predicted that these monoclonal antibodies wouldn't work, just on basic principle. And we now know today the first study failed. So the pursuit has been expensive drugs, whereas there are a lot of repurposed drugs which are cheap and maybe effective, and nobody seems to be interested.
Let me go one step further. As of today, according to a report out of Great Britain by Eve Smith, this is one of the largest studies done on COVID and immunity, and it raises concerns about vaccine strategy because they're finding it, even those individuals who have been exposed, had COVID, the antibodies diminish substantially and back to normal levels, much like the common cold, which means you could be reinfected when those antibodies get to a certain level, and therefore the vaccines are being based upon producing the protective antibodies. So if out of 350,000 people determined that the percentage of COVID antibodies had fallen in the last few months, we're talking about 2 to 3 months, then what would be the odds that a vaccine would be able to sustain those antibodies? And it's all theoretical. It's a mathematical model at this point. And instead of looking at the things that you know and that the scientific literature shows right now in thousands upon thousands of patients, like hydroxychloroquine, and yet they come around, and this ties in with something I'd like you to address, please, because they're doing the same thing to you. They said, the New England Journal of Medicine, the British Medical Journal, The Lancet said that hydroxychloroquine not only has no beneficial effect, it's actually dangerous. But then it had to retract both articles because both were wrong. And one of the things we found is that Anthony Fauci, first in 2015, supported hydroxychloroquine, but now he doesn't. And then we hear from a professor that we never hear from. He is an MD, PhD. He is one of the most respected epidemiologists in the world. He has published over 300 articles in peer-reviewed journals. He sits on the board as an independent scientist in peer-reviewed journals. And he's at Yale. And he's never had controversy in his life. And he said that hydroxychloroquine had some of the best results of any drug he's ever seen on patients with the least toxicity. And then it turns out the toxicity they were using in the hospitals were end stage and upwards as high as 9,000 milligrams in an end stage person on a ventilator. Of course, they're going to die. He is suggesting, and the other doctors, between 200 to 400 milligrams twice a day with zinc and an antibiotic. And they're seeing symptoms subside and people return to health. And you have thousands of doctors now who signed a petition. As of today, I just looked, it was 12,000 medical doctors from around the world and over 30,000 scientists, Nobel Prize winners, top scientists saying we must reevaluate the political ramifications of quarantining everybody again, which they're now doing in Great Britain starting today. And then now they're advocating the United States in different places. And instead of looking at drugs that are available that are not toxic, especially in the proper dosage, and especially for people who are at risk with comorbidities. And none of that is being advocated by Fauci and the powers that be, who are controlling everything behind the scenes with the pharmaceutical company, of looking at these vaccines, purely experimental. We don't know what's going to work or not. I would hope they work, but we have something that does work. And to me, this makes no sense unless there's an economic or ideological agenda. And now they're attacking that doctor at Yale. They want to have him thrown off the staff.
Yeah,
so just as they have with you.
You know, what the so-called medical community is doing is it says, we're going to just wait until we get a vaccine, because the vaccine will solve the issue without actually dealing with the issue. Now, if we get a vaccine, that will be great. But you know what? There's no certainty it will work. It's going to be months away. And there are absolutely things we can do now to control this pandemic without actually locking people up. We don't need to lock them up. There are simple things we can do. And there are a whole host of medications we think that can help. One of the obvious is vitamin D. We know vitamin D is really important in respiratory tract infections. There's overwhelming data that patients who die of COVID have low levels. There's data that suggests if you give them vitamin D, you improve their outcome. Vitamin D is as cheap as hell. And the people who need it are those that are most vulnerable. You know, people in long-term care facilities who never get outside and get sunshine. These people are 100% vitamin D deficient. So they should be given vitamin D. They should be given vitamin C. They should be given zinc. These are all very cheap things that can be done. And there's no question that, you know, hydroxychloroquine has become such a political thing. But I think if you're going to use it, you have to use it with zinc. And it has to be used early. I think there's no question that if it's used late in the hospital, you've missed the boat. But there, you know, in addition to hydroxychloroquine, there are a lot of other substances, naturopathic medicines that hold a lot of promise. One of them is quercetin, which is a plant flavonoid, which, as it so happens, has specific activity against SARS-CoV-2. It is anti-inflammatory. So, you know, there are a lot of potential repurposed cheap medications we can use. However, they were pushing remdesivir, which I think costs like $3,000 a course. And we know now remdesivir does not work. We know definitely the Solidarity study was done and remdesivir did not reduce mortality.
Yet it's still being promoted by Fauci.
Yeah, so
they have not withdrawn it.
It's very difficult to understand. So I can tell you another little anecdotal story. So we've had a protocol for...
Let me just say we have to say goodbye to our WBAI audience. Thank you all for listening. And we're continuing on with stations all over the world on the Progressive Radio Network to the top of the hour. Please continue, Dr. Merrick.
So we've had a protocol for COVID-19, which we kind of made available on the 13th of March. And it included corticosteroids, and it included heparin, and included vitamin C. We were accused by some of the leading physicians of this country of practicing medical malpractice because we were prescribing steroids. The WHO had a declaration saying that corticosteroids were contraindicated in COVID up until May the 27th. It just so happens that corticosteroids are the only drug absolutely proven without any shadow of doubt to reduce the death rate in patients with severe COVID. And part of the issue is corticosteroids are really cheap. And you don't hear the so-called task force talking much about corticosteroids, which save lives, but they talk about remdesivir and monoclonal antibodies, which don't work and are expensive. So I think the medical leadership has failed. We're in a really precarious situation. I think it's like the Black Plague of centuries ago. It's a free for all.
I'm sorry that they have attacked you. I could only imagine what it would be to be a distinguished professor of internal medicine, to be highly acclaimed in your field, have a 30-year blemish-free reputation, and now you're attacked and vilified. But just understand, There are some remarkable human beings on this planet. Dr. Abraham Hoffer, Dr. Linus Pauling, the man who discovered and won the Nobel Prize for discovering ascorbic acid, Albert Szent-Györgyi, who I know. These people also were attacked once they showed that it was not just important and necessary, not just to prevent scurvy, but could be used as a functional nutrient against disease, then they were attacked. There are at least 500 doctors who I've personally spoken with in my career, which is over 53 years my career, and who have all been attacked for saving lives, for doing things that other doctors, now mind you, these were board-certified physicians. They had all gone to the same schools, Harvard, Yale, all these people. Many were my friends, like Dr. Martin Feldman. And when he saw that the protocols given in medical school, which he abided by and had published 63 articles in peer-reviewed literature, were not helping his neurologically challenged patients, he began to look at nutrition, changing the diet, more exercise, more stress management, certain nutrients. And then he simply one day called me because he was a close friend of mine. He said, Gary, he said, I realized the strength and weakness of my background. He graduated number one at Yale, all right, and then college physician surgeon at Columbia. And he said, I realize that I am a victim. And I said, of what? He said, propaganda. He said, I wish that medical schools would allow students an opportunity to challenge where appropriate the teachings, the protocols, so they don't go out there and continue to do something that works and something that doesn't work. And he says, I know what doesn't work now, and I've changed my entire practice. And by the way, from that day in 1975 till he died just last 2 years ago, he was an alternate practice. You don't get any higher in ranking than he did. You don't become, you know, professor of neurology at Mount Sinai and all the other things he did. But never again was he looked upon by orthodox medicine as one of their guiding lights. He was all this poor guy who got misdirected into this quackery. And unfortunately, you have now been, at some point, I believe that you will simply have to say, I'm going to keep treating patients the way I see, and if it doesn't agree with your consensus of opinion, then come and watch me day by day, and you'll see the difference between your opinion, which is subjective, and my working with patients saving lives every day, which is real. Your final thoughts, sir.
Yeah, so I have invited people to come see for themselves. None have come. So what keeps me going is I get a lot of feedback from hundreds of patients who, you know, attribute our protocol to saving their life. And that's what keeps us going because, you know, the truth has no sides and it will eventually emerge. The problem is we've created a generation of physicians that are closed-minded. They cannot look out of out of the box. They rigidly follow protocols, and I think they completely have lost direction. But you know, we have to continue because you know our primary Hippocratic duty is to do the best for the patient in front of us, regardless of their creed, their race, their religion, and the ability to pay. And that's what we have to do. And that's what keeps us going. And it's the grateful patients who turn around that, you know, give us encouragement to continue.
Good for you. You might want to have the, if they're willing to do it, the Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, maybe put a plaque up saying Socrates works here because you're following his principles. All right. Dr. Paul Merrick. For us, we are on your side, and we are a large audience. This is the largest progressive radio audience in the world. So now they know who you are. They know the truth. So the next time someone challenges it and tries to slander you, we will be there to push back on your behalf.
Thank you kindly.
All the best. Bye. We're out of time, people. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.